Hey, Mark.
Yes, Danny.
We finally made it.
It's odds and sods time.
Welcome to the Wind Machine Podcast, not your average Eurovision podcast. My name's Danny Tregoning, and today I'm joined by the odd to my sod, Mark Perkins.
Hi, everyone. Yes, I'm very odd, and you're a bit of a sod.
I'm totally a sod. Well, I was like, look, we're doing three countries today. I can't do like a food thing.
Well, we're both odd and sod, so, you know.
Pretty much. So if you haven't figured it out, you've had a few hints. Last episode, we finally picked odds and sods out of the Yona Beanie of Doom. So if you're new to all this, you're wondering what odds and sods is about. Well, because we always do five songs of a country that has participated in Eurovision from 2000 to now, some of them don't have five.
Correct.
So we've lumped them all in together, which means that this episode's going to have some very different songs kind of slammed together into one podcast.
And those three countries are
Slovakia,
Monaco,
and Australia. So we've picked our top two from each country. We have
a pumping tune from 2012.
A sweet song about escaping to nature.
Eurovision Goes South Pacific.
A 16-year-old sings about environmental issues.
Let's cancel tomorrow. Tonight was great.
And I keep calling, calling, I keep calling. I can't do that high thing. No, forget it. I can't do it. I think my voice is still ruined from karaoke.
So let's begin. First up, it's Slovakia. The Slovak Republic is a landlocked country in Central Europe. It is bordered by Poland to the north, Ukraine to the east, the Czech Republic to the west, Hungary to the south, and Austria to the southwest. Slovakia's territory spans about 49,000 square kilometres. Slovakia is a high-income advanced economy and has a very high standard of living and performs favourably in measurements of civil liberties, press freedom, internet freedom, democratic governance, and peacefulness. Citizens of Slovakia are provided with universal health care, free education, and one of the longest paid maternity leave in the OECD. The country joined the European Union in 2004 and the Eurozone on the 1st of January 2009. Slovakia is also a member of the Schengen area, NATO, and the United Nations.
The current form of the national flag of Slovakia was adopted by Slovakia's constitution, which came into force on the 3rd of September 1992. The flag, in common with other Slavic nations, uses the colour white, blue and red. And I always get it confused with Slovenia.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? The colour of the triangle in the flag of Czechoslovakia was taken from the blue strip in Slovakia's flag, representing its presence in the Union. While Czechoslovakia dissolved, the Czech Republic simply retained the flag, in direct violation of the 1992 Act on the Division of Czechoslovakia, which explicitly forbade state symbols to be used by two successor states. Drama.
So, listeners, if you haven't realised by now, Slovakia was once part of Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it?
So it's now Slovakia and the Czech Republic. The official language is Slovak, a member of the Slavic language family. Hungarian is widely spoken in the southern regions, and Rusyn is used in some parts of the northeast. Slovakia is ranked among the top EU countries regarding the knowledge of foreign languages. In 2007, 68% of the population aged between 25 and 64 years old claimed to speak two or more foreign languages, finishing second highest in the European Union. The best known foreign language in Slovakia is Czech, of course. Eurostat report also shows that 98.3% of Slovak students in the upper secondary education take on two foreign languages, ranking higher than the average 60.1% in the European Union.
They're a bit clever already, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll start with our first song. We only had four from Slovakia, so...
So it was a 50% success rate.
It was a 50% success rate, and I think this one is a bit of a banger. From 2012, here's Max Jason Mai with Don't Close Your Eyes. Jason Mai, born Miro Samudja. I'm thinking that's right. It's got a little hat on the S. You know how I love the hats. Was born in 1988 in former Czechoslovakia. He is a Slovak musician, singer and songwriter, best known as the lead vocalist and frontman of the rock pop band Therapy and alternate metalcore band Max J. Mai. It's always nice when you name it after yourself.
Yes.
Max came second in Slovak Idol. The song came last in the semi on 22 points. Well, this one is actually quite popular, even though it came last.
Yeah.
Yeah, we always tend to sort of find sometimes the last places are still good songs.
Yeah.
The official clip, David Lynch. How are you going?
Yeah, very surreal.
Ooh, Okay, it's a little bit creepy, and we're in like some kind of medical type of place. I want to say hospital, but it's screaming asylum.
Asylum, yeah, and there's figures that look like Slender Man.
Yes, well, I've actually written down the gentleman from Buffy.
Well, that too, Hush, yeah. The gentleman, yeah.
So I don't know if they're supposed to be doctors or whatever, but their faces are covered.
Could have been a promotion for Resident Evil, perhaps.
Oh, maybe.
No, I don't know.
So we're concentrating on one lady, and she seems to have a few things going on, poor darling. And we get to watch her doing some manic typing and then some crazy painting. But then Max breaks in and saves her. He's a bit of a hero, I think.
He is.
He is. The Eurovision stage, we've got everything that we need from a rock act. We've got strobe lighting. We've got a full band. Max has the biggest hair and the tightest chest. He looks like David Lee Roth of Slovakia.
Yeah.
He really does. But seriously, that performance was pumping.
It was. It just, again, we say this all the time, how did it end up being last?
Look, I don't know. We'll get into a little bit about why Slovakia left Eurovision.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Were they not part of a sufficient block?
It could have been as simple as that.
Because, you know, we always say this, someone has to come last, but this didn't deserve last. In 2012, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's true.
There were some shockers in Baku. Like, yeah, come on. Yeah, look, not fair. Because we're doing three countries, we've had to cut down a lot on the history.
Very condensed.
We're going to whet your appetite with some dot points of what we think is essential to your historical knowledge.
So I've started with, in my notes, 2 AD, the expanding Roman Empire established and maintained a series of outposts around and just north of the Danube, the largest of which was known as Carnuntum, whose remains are on the main road halfway between Vienna and Bratislava. And Bratislava, as we've now found out, is the capital of modern-day Slovakia.
Thanks, Fleur.
And Brigitio, present-day Sosny. That's probably pronounced incorrectly again.
It's got a hat on the O.
It's got a hat. At the Slovak-Hungarian border. Such Roman border settlements were built on the present area of Roskovice, currently a suburb of Bratislava. In the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD, the Huns of Attila the Hun fame crossed the Danube in 377 AD and occupied Pannonia, which we've mentioned in a few other podcasts.
We have.
Which they used for 75 years as their base for launching looting raids into Western Europe. However, Attila's death in 453 brought about the disappearance of the Hun tribe. In 568, a Turco-Mongol tribal confederacy, the Avars, which we've again mentioned in previous podcasts, conducted its own invasion into the Middle Danube region. The Avars occupied the lowlands of the Pannonian Plain and established an empire dominating the Carpathian Basin. The Slavic tribes settled in the territory of present-day Slovakia in the 5th century. In 623, the Slavic population living in the western parts of Pannonia seceded from their empire after a revolution. After 626, the Avar power started a gradual decline, but its reign lasted to 804. A Slavic state known as the Principality of Nitra arose in the 8th century, together with neighbouring Moravia, the Soror of Moravia. The principality formed the core of the great Moravian Empire from 833. Following the disintegration of the great Moravian Empire at the turn of the 10th century, the Hungarians annexed the territory comprising modern Slovakia.
From the 11th century until 1918, when the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed, the territory of modern Slovakia was an integral part of the Hungarian state. In medieval times! The area of present-day Slovakia was characterized by German and Jewish immigration, burgeoning towns, construction of numerous stone castles, and the cultivation of the arts. We like the arts. Owing to the Ottoman Empire's expansion into Hungarian territory, Bratislava was designated as the new capital of Hungary in 1536. The territory comprising modern Slovakia was then known as Upper Hungary, not Upper Fern Tree Gully. During a revolution in 1848 to 1849, the Slovaks supported the Austrian Emperor, hoping for independence from the Hungarian part of the dual monarchy, but they failed to achieve their aim. Therefore, relations between the nationalities deteriorated, culminating in the secession of Slovakia from Hungary after World War I. In 1918, Slovakia and the regions of Bohemia, Moravia, Czech Silesia, and Carpathian Ruthenia formed a common state, Czechoslovakia, with the borders confirmed by the Treaty of Saint-Germain and the Treaty of Trianon. In 1919, during the chaos following the breakup of the Austria-Hungary, Czechoslovakia was formed with numerous Germans and Hungarians within the newly set borders.
The so-called Munich Agreement of September 1938 allowed Nazi Germany to partially dismember the country by occupying what was called the Sudetenland, a region with a German-speaking majority and bordering Germany and Austria. Nazi Germany threatened to annex part of Slovakia and allow the remaining regions to be partitioned by Hungary and Poland unless independence was declared. Thus, Slovakia seceded from Czechoslovakia in March 1939 and allied itself, as demanded by Germany, with Hitler's coalition. Secession had created the first Slovak state in history. After World War II, Czechoslovakia was reconstituted, thanks, Allied powers.
Yay!
In 1969, Czechoslovakia became a federation of the Czech Socialist Republic and the Slovak Socialist Republic. Czechoslovakia was never part of the Soviet Union and remained independent to a degree. The end of communist rule in Czechoslovakia in 1989, during the peaceful Velvet Revolution, was followed once again by the country's dissolution, this time into two successor states. In July 1992, Slovakia declared itself a sovereign state. The Slovak Republic and the Czech Republic went their separate ways after the 1st of January 1993, an event sometimes called the Velvet Divorce, and they are still divorced to this day.
They are. It's stuck. The Slovak Constitution guarantees freedom of religion. In 2011, 62% of Slovaks identified themselves as Roman Catholics, 9% as Protestants, 4% as Greek Catholics, 1% as Orthodox, and 13% identified themselves as atheists or non-religious. Parliament passed a new bill that will obstruct Islam and other religious organisations from becoming state-recognised religions by doubling the minimum followers threshold from 25,000 to 50,000.
That's a bit underhanded.
The law passed by a two-third majority of the parliament. In 2010, there was an estimated 5,000 Muslims in Slovakia, representing less than 0.1% of the country's population. Slovakia is the last member state of the European Union without a mosque. That's interesting, isn't it?
I guess they're not accepting refugees right now.
No, I don't think so.
I was beginning to like Slovakia, but that sort of put me off a little bit.
It's very strange to cap a religion at a certain amount of numbers.
Fine if it's a cult like, you know, Scientology.
Branch Davidians.
But come on, Islam is a recognised religion. You can't do that. So from exclusion in religion to the next song, which makes absolutely no connection whatsoever.
There is no connection.
Here's Horohoni by Christina Pelikova from 2010.
It's a song. Slnko skloní na hore hroní, chce sa mi spievať, zomrieť a žiť. Keď sa slnko skloní na hore hroní, túžim sa k nebu priblížiť. Na tráve ležím a snívam, o čom sama neviem. V tom vánku, čo ma kolíše, keď je slnko najnižšie. Najkrajšie stromy sú na hore hroní, to tiché bratstvo vraví poď. Sem sa vždy vrátim, keď ma niečo zroní, pravia tie stromy spliec to zhoď. Na tráve ležím a snívam, o čom sama
Kristina Pelikova, born 1987, is a Slovak singer. Kristina started her career as a child singer, dancer, and piano player in Svidnik. Following the advice of her music teacher, she took singing as her major and attended the Conservatoire in Kosice. Horihony is a rural region in Slovakia. The lyrics tell the story of a heartbroken girl who finds solace in the nature, its woods, and black hills to make her grief disappear. The song came 16th in the semi on 24 points.
Every time we try and say this is
horror.
It's a gorgeous song, though. Yeah. It really stood out when we were, you know, trying to figure out what our two for Slovakia were going to be. The official clip is a bit weird because it's kind of a little bit of national final and a little bit of just other stuff just shoved in. It's quite...
Yeah, we did find some other YouTube videos which we weren't sure whether they were trying to be karaoke or unofficial videos which showed what I presume to be Horihony countryside.
Yes, it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's green and lovely. Now, funnily enough, the green theme does carry on into the performances. So the official clip, we're basically... National final, we had people dressed as trees.
Woodland elves.
Yeah, well, she was very elven.
Yeah.
So four dancers and one backup singer. So going to Eurovision, they pretty much copied that.
Yes.
And just made it greener.
Yeah.
It was just greener. But, yeah, it's really, it's a lovely song. And now that I know what it's about, I think I appreciate it more. Because sometimes when you're feeling a bit off, getting outside is really good for you.
Yes.
I wish I could hike.
I love hiking
when
I get around
to do it. I'd love to go for a hike. Like, it just, you know, it put you in touch with nature.
I could put a rope around you and, you know, pull you up.
You could just drag
me. I could
on
drag
a
you. You know, it could work, you know.
That's almost as good as when we went to Vasquez Rocks, remember? And we're trying to do it with me in a wheelchair. Yeah, that
was... Yeah, no, don't do that.
I definitely got in touch with nature that day.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I got in touch with your dark side.
Especially when I ended up in a ditch.
I'm sorry. What I was disappointed in this clip, there was no hobbitses.
No hobbitses with big fairy feet.
No, my precious.
Damn.
But, and I think Wee Wee Blogs picked this up a few years back, I think she was inspired by Ruslana's Wild Dancers, because the costume's obviously completely different and the idea behind it's completely different, but the choreography is very similar.
Oh, the chore is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, really good. And, you know, they hold her up and spin around and it's all very cool. Mm. But, yes. So, thinking about trees.
Yes.
It's a nice little segue into Slovakia, geography, climate, and kind of politics, I guess.
Well, maybe the politicians are trees, you know.
Maybe they are here. The Slovak landscape is noted primarily for its mountainous nature, with the Carpathian Mountains extending across most of the northern part of the country. There are also 9 national parks in Slovakia, and they cover about 7% of the land surface. Slovakia has hundreds of caves, or like caves, and caverns under its mountains, and about 30 are open to the public. The Slovak climate lies between a temperate and continental climate zone with relatively warm summers and cold and cloudy, humid winters. The temperature extremes are between minus 41. To 40.
Gah.
That's even worse. There are 4 distinct seasons, and each season lasts about 3 months.
Shock horror. Would they be summer, spring, winter, and autumn?
Hey, we're in autumn and we're still having summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's not start. The dry continental air brings the summer heat and winter frosts. In contrast, oceanic air brings rainfall and reduces summer temperatures. In the lowlands and valleys, fog happens often, especially in winter.
Yeah, fog kind of does that.
Does that. It hangs around too, pea soup.
Slovakia is a parliamentary democratic republic with a multi-party system, just like most of Europe.
Yep.
The Slovak head of state and the formal head of the executive is the president. The president is elected by direct popular vote under the 2-round system for a 5-year term. Most executive power lies with the head of government, the prime minister, who is usually the leader of the winning party. But he/she needs to form a majority coalition in the parliament. The prime minister is appointed by the president. The remainder of the cabinet is appointed by the president on the recommendation of the prime minister. The armed forces of the Slovak Republic number 14,000 uniformed personnel. The country has been an active participant in US and NATO-led military actions. From 2006, the army transitioned into a fully professional organisation and compulsory military service was abolished. Slovak ground forces are made up of 2 active mechanised infantry brigades. The Air Defence Force comprise 1 wing of fighters, 1 wing of utility helicopters, and 1 SAM brigade, whatever the heck that means.
2 of our countries are no longer in Eurovision. And we'll find out why. So why is Slovakia no longer in Eurovision? This is why. Slovakia has participated in the Eurovision Song Contest 7 times, debuting in 1994. It had attempted to debut in 1993, but did not pass through that strange qualifying round. In the first 3 finals that Slovakia participated, it placed no better than 18th.
Ouch.
Yeah, which it achieved in 1996. Because of poor results, it was forced to miss a year after each contest, and then the country opted out not to return for a couple of years. They did eventually return to the contest 11 years later. That was a nice big break. In 2009. From 2009 to 2012, they fared poorly. So RTVS decided to withdraw in 2013. They have continued to withdraw from entering since, citing financial constraints and programming issues.
Listeners, you can't see this, but we're doing air quotes.
Programming issues.
We don't want to go last again.
Pretty much. So, since we go from 2000, between 2009 and 2012, Slovakia performed songs in Slovak twice and English twice. They would usually give their points to Malta, Estonia, Sweden, and Norway, and receive most points from Malta, Ukraine, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Greece. Gee, Malta must be really missing those extra points that Slovakia would give them.
I reckon.
Poor Malta.
No, they shouldn't worry about it this year, but...
No, they shouldn't. I think Malta will do okay this year.
Wind Machine Podcast.
So, let's move on to our next country. It's Monaco. The Principality of Monaco is a sovereign city-state country and microstate on the French Riviera in Western Europe. France borders the country on three sides, while the other side borders the Mediterranean Sea. Monaco has an area of, wait for it, 2.02 kilometres square. Whoa.
That's huge.
And a population of about, wait for it, 38,400.
That's not a good AFL turnout.
No.
No.
With 19,009 inhabitants per square kilometre, though, it is the second smallest and most densely populated sovereign state in the world. Monaco has a land border of 5.47 kilometres, a coastline of 3.83 kilometres.
It's tiny!
Jeez, you could go for a run through the whole country in like 2 minutes or something.
You could circle the country quite easily.
Yeah. Monaco is known as a playground for the rich and famous due to its tax laws. Well, of course, the rich like to not pay their taxes.
Absolutely.
In 2014, it was noted about 30% of the population was made up of millionaires, more than in Zurich and Geneva. Monaco is not formally a part of the European Union, but it participates in certain EU policies, including customs and border controls.
You know what I associate Monaco with? Bold and the Beautiful.
Oh, I associate Monaco with... Yes.
The national flag of Monaco has two equal horizontal bands of red at the top and white at the bottom.
Hi, Indonesia.
Yeah, both which have been the heraldic colours of the House of Grimaldi since at least 1339. The present bicolour design was adopted on the 4th of April 1881 under Prince Charles III, not our Charlie. The flag of Monaco is graphically identical to the flag of Indonesia, with a slight difference only in the dimension ratios. I panicked a bit the other night because I put the flags on our socials, and then, of course, Lookme went, oh, hi, Indonesia. And I went, oh, did I do the right flag? It is the right flag. It's okay. I wasn't failed by my iPhone. The official language of Monaco is French. Well, funny that. While Italian is spoken by the principality's sizable community from Italy. Thus, French and Italian supplants the Occitan language, the vernacular language of the Monegasque. It doesn't even look like that when it's written down. It looks like
Mozambique or something.
Which is not recognised as an official language. English is used by the American, British, Anglo-Canadian and Irish residents. The Grimaldi, princes of Monaco, have Ligurian origin. Thus, the traditional national language is Monegasque, a variety of the Ligurian, now spoken by only a minority of residents and a common language to many native residents. In Monacoville, street signs are printed in both French and Monegasque.
I guess we should go to our first song for Monaco.
Well, why not? This one's fun too.
Yeah, and absolutely no bearing on Monaco's heritage at all.
No, not at all.
From 2006, here's La Coco Dance by Severine Ferrer. Severine Ferrer was born in Montpellier in 1977 and grew up on the island of Réunion. In 1991, Severine and her family moved to Paris. She began her career by appearing on television. This was the first and, to date, the only occasion on which the Tahitian language was used at the contest. The song is inspired by island music, particularly that of the South Pacific. Severine sings about the need to relax and let the world pass one by, as well as to let yourself go and come dancing. We're dancing! She then tells her listeners that when you feel your luck below zero, they should join with her in the titular Coco Dance, which is apparently related to the tamu of French Polynesia. The chorus itself is delivered in Tahitian, while the dance instructions are in French. The song came a respectable... Not respectable. 21st in the semi-final on 14 points. Woo!
Hey, look, 14 points is all right. Hey, you know, microstates sometimes have trouble.
San Marino.
Points, San Marino. The official clip. This looks like it was thrown together.
It sure was. Oh, my.
Okay, so it's basically Severine in a recording studio and she's having trips in helicopters, she's having photo shoots, and it's rehearsals for Eurovision. Whoa.
It's almost like a postcard before a postcard.
It is a postcard before a postcard. But when we get to the Eurovision stage, we go full South Pacific. Now, I'm not talking, I got to wash that man right out of my hair. I'm talking grass skirts, men in traditional garb with naked chests. Hello. Her dress is like a sunrise. So it's all...
like a sunrise.
Yeah, like a sunrise. So we're going through all, you know, the kind of reds and oranges and yellows and all that stuff. So we've got the two ladies that sing a bit and then the two boys who sing in Tahitian.
Yes.
It's quite a feast for the eyes. There's a bit of something for everyone in this one.
Yeah, there is, you know.
Some good-looking ladies, some good-looking blokes. Hey, I can't say no.
We all win.
But yeah, South Pacific.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suddenly have a thing to go watch a musical. But I won't. What I will do is talk about, well, I'll start talking about the history of Monaco. Monaco was first ruled by a member of the House of Grimaldi in 1297 when Francesco Grimaldi and his men captured the fortress protecting the Rock of Monaco while dressed as monks.
Ooh, that sounds like it'd be a good movie, like
it
a heist
does.
Movie.
An ousted branch of the Genoese family from the Republic of Genoa. Did you know her? Nah, I didn't know her. And the Grimaldi contested the land of modern-day Monaco. Though the Republic of Genoa would last until the 19th century, they allowed the Grimaldi family to keep Monaco. Well, that was nice of them. Later, after a number of conflicts between Genoa and the Crown of Aragon, not from...
Lord of the Rings.
Not from Lord of the Rings.
That's two pop culture references to Lord of the Rings.
I know, how weird. A confederacy of principalities that included Catalonia, the Grimaldi family in 1419 purchased Monaco from the Crown of Aragon and it became the official and undisputed rulers of the Rock of Monaco.
So Monaco was bought, not settled, bought.
It kind of makes sense though, really,
it does,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
The princes of Monaco thus became vassals of the French kings while in the same time remaining sovereign princes. Between 1793 and 1814, Monaco was occupied by the French, so during the Napoleonic Wars. In 1869, the principality stopped collecting income tax from its residents. God, we should have been there then. That would have been awesome. An indulgence of the Grimaldi family could afford to entertain, thanks solely to the extraordinary successes of the casino.
The casino of Monaco, which I believe was an influence on the casino in Canto Bight from the Star Wars The Last Jedi.
I thought you were going to make another James Bond reference and say it was Casino Royale.
Well, that was the other option, really. Because I'm pretty sure that's where Casino Royale
was. It probably
was.
Is. I don't know. Yeah. This made Monaco not only a playground for the rich, but a favoured place for them to live.
Lifestyles of the rich and famous.
Pretty much.
On the Riviera by Geraldo Riviera. Huh. Dad joke. In March 1910, there were mass protests against the Grimaldi absolute rule. The Monegasci demanded a constitution and a parliament to rein in the absolute monarch, which at the time was Prince Albert I, or else they would overthrow him and establish a republic. Ooh. They were dissatisfied about French domination of the principality's politics and economy. On the 5th of January 1911, Prince Albert I granted Monaco a constitution. Yeah, I think he was a bit worried that he was going to get overthrown. Just a bit. But the document had little real meaning in terms of reducing autocratic rule and was soon suspended by the prince when World War I broke out. Also in 1911, Prince Albert created the Monte Carlo Rally, an automobile race designed to draw tourists to Monaco and the casino. In July 1918, the Franco-Monegasque Treaty was signed, providing for limited French protection over Monaco. In 1993, the Principality of Monaco became a member of the United Nations with full voting rights. The current ruler of Monaco, Albert, is the son of Grace Kelly, the actress, and Prince Rainier III.
Yeah, not bad genes, that.
Not bad genes. And now a quick step into religion. Christians comprise a total of 83.2% of Monaco's population. The official religion is the Catholic Church, with freedom of other religions guaranteed by the Constitution. There you go, Slovakia. There are 5 Catholic parish churches in Monaco and 1 cathedral, which is the see of the Archbishop of Monaco. Protestants are the second largest group after Roman Catholics. The Muslim population of Monaco consists of about 280 people, most of whom are exclusively residents, not citizens. The majority of the Muslim population of Monaco are Arabs, though there are smaller Turkish minorities as well. Monaco does not have any official mosques, but there is a Muslim mosque in nearby Beausoleil, France, within easy walking distance of Monaco.
I'm just going to walk to mosque and I'm going to go to France to do it.
Across the border.
Yeah. Hey, look, it works. So we've kind of touched on, you know, it's a nice place for the rich and famous and all that stuff because it has a lovely waterfront.
Yes.
Hmm. This song is kind of about the waterfront. Here's Marion with Notre Planet from 2004.
Prenez soin de notre planète, il y a tant de choses à sauver, la folie des hommes, les tempêtes, l'ont abîmée.
Marion Gargoulio, born 1987 in France, is a singer and songwriter. In 2004, the then 16-year-old was chosen from over 500 competitors to represent Monaco in that year's Eurovision and to be Monaco's first entry since 1979.
Whoa.
I know, huge pressure. Her song was disco-themed about the Mediterranean Sea and its need for protection.
Aww.
Prince Albert congratulated Marion publicly when she was selected to compete in the semi-final. It's not bad to have a prince go, Good on ya. The song came 19th in the semi on 10 points. Basically, the official clip is a tourism video for Monaco.
Yeah.
There's not much going on, is there?
Not much going on.
No,
she's in about three or four places, but it's really a small country, so you can't really go far.
But the thing is, they've got a lot of money.
Yeah.
So why couldn't they pour more money into an official clip?
Yeah, I don't get that.
I don't get it.
No.
They did spend a little bit of money on the Eurovision stage, though, because Marion arrives in a lit-up cloak. I love it when LED gets done properly in clothing. So she sort of looks like she's wearing stars when she appears because the stage is really dark. Then, of course, she takes off the cloak and she's basically dressed as the flag. Just so you know, I'm from Monaco. I'm going to wear red and white. She's got four backup dancers and one backup singer. Look, for a 16-year-old, she had a set of pipes.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's quite a good song. And I honestly do not remember Monaco being in Eurovision at all. That's sad.
Surprise.
Isn't it? I know. Surprise.
And we had three songs to choose from.
We did.
So one had to go bye-bye.
Look, unfortunately, with Monaco, two of them sounded almost identical.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had Le Coco Dance. So we had to basically flip a coin between the two that sounded
the same.
I'm glad we picked this one because it has a nice environmental message to it.
Hmm.
Speaking of environment.
Ah, see where you're going here.
Oh, yeah.
The centre of Monaco is about 16 kilometres from Italy and only 13 kilometres northeast of Nice, France. Monaco's only natural resource is fishing, with almost the entire country being an urban area. Monaco lacks any sort of commercial agricultural industry.
But they have a casino.
Woo! Monaco has a hot summer Mediterranean climate, which is influenced by the oceanic climate and the humid subtropical climate. As a result, it has warm, dry summers and mild, rainy winters. Cool and rainy interludes can interrupt the dry season, the average length of which is also shorter. Summer afternoons are infrequently hot, indeed temperatures greater than 30 degrees are rare, as the atmosphere is temperate because of the constant sea breezes. So it's nice and sunny, but it's cool.
Yeah, I could totally go to Monaco and just sit on my yacht.
Yeah. On the other hand, the nights are very mild due to the fairly high temperature on the sea in summer. Generally, temperatures do not drop below 20 degrees in this season. In the winter, frosts and snowfalls are extremely rare and generally occur once or twice every 10 years.
That would be epic to have snowfall if it only happens like once or twice every 10 years. It'd be like, oh, the cycle's gone round again, it's time for snow. Monaco has been governed under a constitutional monarchy since 1911, with the sovereign Prince of Monaco as the head of state. The executive branch consists of a minister of state as the head of government, who presides over a five-member council of government. That's tiny. Until 2002, the Minister of State was a French citizen appointed by the prince from among candidates proposed by the French government. Since a constitutional amendment in 2002, the Minister of State can be French or Monégasque. Under the 1962 constitution, the prince shares his veto power with the unicameral National Council. The 24 members of the National Council are elected for five-year terms. 16 are chosen through the majority electoral system and 8 by proportional representation. All legislation requires the approval of the National Council, which is currently dominated by the Conservative Rally and Issues for Monaco party, which holds 20 seats. Union Monégasque holds 3 seats, while Renaissance holds 1 seat. Why does it not surprise me that it's mostly Conservative government?
We don't want to pay taxes. Money, money, monies.
So, of course, Monaco is the other country that is no longer in Eurovision.
Yes.
So, tell us why.
Sure, Danny. Monaco participated in the contest 21 times between its debut in 1959 and 1979. Afterwards, the country withdrew from the contest for financial reasons. Yeah. It only returned in 2004, 25 years after its last participation. It withdrew again in 2007 after failing to qualify for the final for three consecutive years. We joke, but they have the money. They cannot use that excuse.
I know, it's ridiculous.
Monaco won the contest in 1971. The Monegasque victory is rather particular in the history of Eurovision because the songwriter, the singer, and the director were not from the country they represented, but from France. Well, that probably wasn't too hard.
No.
Monaco's next best placing has been second, which it has achieved once in 1962. It has been third three times in 1960, 64 and 76, and last twice in 1959 and 1966. Monaco is among the eight countries which finished last on their first participation, the others being Austria, Portugal, Malta, Turkey, Lithuania, the Czech Republic, and San Marino.
Ouch. Could you imagine? It's like, yay, we're in Eurovision. Oh, we came last.
Between 2004 and 2006, two songs were sung in French and one song sung in French and Tahitian, which we've discussed.
Yes.
La Coco Dance. Monaco would usually give their top points to France, United Kingdom and Germany. They would usually receive the most points from France, Germany, Italy and the United Kingdom. Is that because a lot of tax avoiders are from those countries, perhaps?
Maybe. And the funny thing is they're all top five countries.
So that's where all the money comes from.
Interesting.
Wind Machine Podcast.
We're up to our last country.
Tell us, Danny, what that last country is.
Well, let's just step outside for a moment and take a look at Australia. The Commonwealth of Australia is a sovereign country comprising of the mainland of the Australian continent, the island of Tasmania, and numerous smaller islands. It is the largest country in Oceania and the world's sixth largest country by total area. It's a very big island. The neighbouring countries are Papua New Guinea, Indonesia and East Timor to the north, the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu to the northeast, and New Zealand to the southeast. Australia has the world's ninth largest immigrant population, with immigrants accounting for 26% of the population. The flag of Australia is a defaced blue ensign. That's so Australian to be defaced. A blue field with the Union Jack with the Canton upper hoist quarter and a large seven-pointed star known as the Commonwealth Star in the lower hoist quarter. The fly contains a representation of the Southern Cross constellation made up of five white stars, one small five-pointed star and four larger seven-pointed stars. Now, don't forget the Union Jack, of course, is made up of all of the smaller countries. So you've got all the crosses on top of everything. Then the Commonwealth Star has the number of states and territories.
That's right.
And when you look at the New Zealand flag, people go, oh, they look the same. No, they don't. Because they can't actually see that small star in the Southern Cross, and then they put red around the edges.
That's right.
Most government facilities now will have the Australian flag, the Aboriginal flag, and the Torres Strait Islander flag. So essentially, we have three flags.
Yes. Yeah. Although Australia has no official language... Oh, should we stop talking then if we've got no language?
Do we start talking gibberish?
English has always been entrenched as the de facto national language. You guys speak Australian if you come to this country.
Mate, Davo had a bit of biffo at the servo last night and ended up having to go in the back of the ambo.
Australian English is a major variety of the language with a distinctive accent and lexicon, as you can tell by your hosts, and differs slightly from other varieties of English in grammar and spelling. General Australian serves as the standard dialect. According to a 2016 census, English is the only language spoken in the home for close to 72.7% of the population. The next most common language spoken in the home are Mandarin, Arabic, Cantonese, Vietnamese, and Italian. A considerable proportion of first and second generation immigrants are bilingual. And the beauty of our country is that we are a multicultural country, so we welcome people from all over the world.
That's exactly right. Well, we should.
Over 250 Indigenous Australian languages are thought to have existed at the time of the first European contact, of which less than only 20 are still in daily use by all age groups. About 110 others are spoken exclusively by older people. At the time of the 2006 census, 52,000 Indigenous Australians, representing 12% of the Indigenous population, reported that they spoke an Indigenous language at home.
I don't want tomorrow. Oh, baby, tonight's so good.
Tonight's so good.
From 2015, here's Guy Sebastian with Tonight Again.
Oh, everyone's got their problems. There's always something on your mind. Oh, but tonight we ain't gotta solve them. For now, let's leave them all behind. Oh, do what you want. Do what you want. Do what you want. Oh, get on it, ooh, get on it.
Guy Theodore Sebastian, Ted, born 1981 in Malaysia, is an Australian singer-songwriter. He was the first winner of Australian Idol in 2003 and has been a judge on Australia's The X Factor. Guy's father is Malaysian Indian of Tamil origin and Ceylonese descent with distant colonial Portuguese roots, and his mother is an ethnic Eurasian of English and Portuguese descent, and she was raised in India. Honestly, this guy, is pretty much a world person.
Yes.
Guy has released 9 top 10 albums,
wow,
including 2 number ones. The song came fifth in the final and it was an automatic qualifier, so it didn't have to go through the semi-finals, on 196 points. I absolutely lost my crap when we found out that Australia was going to join Eurovision. And seriously, I know there's a lot of naysayers saying that, you know, Australia shouldn't be part of it. We're not in Europe, la, la, la. Look, seriously, we're consistently pretty good.
Yes.
So let us stay.
Look, yeah, to the naysayers, get over it. Honestly, we're here. We may not stay. Asia Vision's coming up soon. So,
yeah, we'll see what that means.
We'll
see.
Let's just have fun.
That's right. The official clip is pretty much just Guy recording. I think it's actually at his home.
Yeah, it does look like that.
Yeah, it's got kind of knickknacks around and stuff. I have to say, I expected more from this official clip.
It was fine. Like, yeah, it wasn't outstanding.
There's no storyline to it.
There's no storyline.
You know, I like a storyline.
Well, yeah. It could have, yeah. I think it was quickly put together. But, you know, it does show, I guess, what goes into making a song.
Yeah, working hard, being creative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I can't say no to that. The Eurovision stage, I remember we were sitting on our respective couches, because we have two couches, listeners, and he owns one and I own the other. And we sat there with bated breath for that final. We knew that Guy could do it.
Oh, yeah, we knew that.
But when he did it, it was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It was absolutely flawless.
Exactly. Like, fifth place, easily deserved.
Easily deserved. Now, really, the actual staging was quite basic. It was Guy, four backup singers, and pretty much a road.
Like, it was sort of like a street sort of alley, and it sort of had a sort of 1920s, 1930s vibe.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, the way it was moving, it was like they were walking down the road, and that was it.
I loved it.
But it didn't need anything huge.
No. It totally worked.
It totally worked, and of course he looked very snazzy in his suit and hat. I do like a hat on a man, sir hat. Now, of course, Australian history is ginormous, and we know that majority of our listeners are Australian. So if you're not an Australian, we're going to give you some points.
Yes.
About what has happened to get us here now.
So, human habitation of the Australian continent is estimated to have begun around 65 to 70,000 years ago, with a migration of people by land bridges and short sea crossings from what is now Southeast Asia. These first inhabitants were the ancestors of our modern Indigenous Australians. Indigenous Australians have an oral culture with spiritual values based on reverence for the land and a belief in the Dreamtime. And because of that oral culture, there's nothing written down about their history.
No, because it's just passed on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we fast forward many thousands of years to the first recorded European sighting of the Australian mainland and the first recorded European landfall on the Australian continent in 1606 was attributed to the Dutch. The Dutch charted the whole of the western and northern coastlines and named the island continent New Holland during the 17th century, but made no attempt at settlement.
Were we not good enough for you?
Fine, Netherlands.
Fine.
William Dampier, an English explorer and privateer, landed on the northwest coast of New Holland in 1688 and again in 1699 on a return trip. Then in 1770, James Cook sailed along and mapped the east coast, which he named New South Wales and claimed for Great Britain.
Do you have a flag?
I claim this for Great Britain. With the loss of its American colonies in 1783, because of the American Revolution, the British government sent a fleet of ships, the First Fleet, under the command of Captain Arthur Phillip to establish a new penal colony in New South Wales. A camp was set up and the flag raised at Sydney Cove, Port Jackson, on the 26th of January 1788. A British settlement was established in Van Diemen's Land, now known as Tasmania, in 1803, and it became a separate colony in 1825. The United Kingdom formally claimed the western part of Western Australia in 1823. Separate colonies were carved from parts of New South Wales, South Australia in 1836, Victoria in 1851, and Queensland in 1859. The Northern Territory was founded in 1911 when it was excised from South Australia. South Australia was founded as a free province. It was never a penal colony. Now, this is where it gets a bit not so good in Australian history.
Mm-hmm.
The indigenous population, estimated to have been between 750,000 and 1 million in 1788, declined for 150 years following settlement, mainly due to infectious diseases and atrocities committed by European settlers. Now, I remember I studied 19th century Australian history, and one massacre of Indigenous Australians, you know, jumped out at me, and it was called the Mile Creek Massacre.
Mm.
Now, the specifics of it elude me at this time, but I know it was one of the most devastating losses in Indigenous Australian history.
Yep.
And for that type of behaviour to continue for some time, and in some parts of Australia, there are some people that still feel that way towards Indigenous Australians, and it is upsetting.
Yep.
They were here first. We have to respect their right to their land.
Absolutely. And before we move forward, we'd both like to thank, you know, the traditional landowners of where this booth sits, because, you know, we are here and we thank them for letting us live on their land. So thank you.
Thank you.
The gold rush began in Australia in the early 1850s, and the Eureka Rebellion against mining license fees in 1854 was the early expression of civil disobedience.
Oh, Aussies, we're good at our civil disobedience.
So are. On the 1st of January 1901, the Federation of Colonies was achieved after a decade of planning, consultation and voting. This established the Commonwealth of Australia as a dominion of the British Empire. And without getting too political, can we make Australia First Australia Day, please?
Sure.
The Federal Capital Territory, later renamed Australian Capital Territory, was formed in 1911 as the location for the future federal capital of Canberra. Melbourne was the temporary seat of government from 1901 to 1927 while Canberra was being constructed.
Yay, Melbourne.
We love Canberra. It's basically built around one huge roundabout. In 1914, Australia joined Britain in fighting in World War One. Britain's Statute of Westminster in 1931 formally ended most of the constitutional links between Australia and the UK. Australia adopted it in 1942, but it was backdated to 1939 to confirm the validity of legislation passed by the Australian Parliament during World War II. The shock of United Kingdom's defeat in Asia in 1942 and the threat of Japanese invasion caused Australia to turn to the United States as a new ally and protector. Since 1951, Australia has been a formal military ally of the US under the ANZUS Treaty. After World War II, Australia encouraged immigration from mainland Europe.
And now Australia is part of a treaty with the US under the Uranus Treaty. Because our leaders are so far up the Americans' ass, it's not funny.
Oh, goodness. Now, think about it. My mum is a 10-pound pom.
Yes.
Which was a thing to encourage, especially British women,
mm-hmm.
to come to Australia and procreate with Australian men. Well, she did what she was told, and that's how I became a person.
What?
I know. But yeah, there were lots of different ways to get people to immigrate. Like, of course, the gold rush. We had a whole heap of Chinese immigrants come over.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just had waves. We've always had waves.
Greeks.
Vietnamese. We've had just waves of people coming and making Australia home.
Yeah. And now we've got recent times, Afghanis and Somalians.
Yep.
So we're welcoming.
Yeah. It's just the next wave.
Yep.
A government policy of assimilation beginning with the Aboriginal Protection Act of 1869 resulted in the removal of many Aboriginal children from their families and communities during the early to mid 20th century. Often referred to as the Stolen Generations, a practice which also contributed to the decline of the Indigenous population. It took until the 13th of February 2008 for an Australian Prime Minister to formally issue an apology to those affected by this policy.
Yes, the Stolen Generation is another dark past of Australia which we are deeply ashamed of.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you, Kevin Rudd.
Yeah.
Even though you could be a drip at times, you actually had the balls to say sorry.
Yep. So, religion. Australia has no state religion. Section 116 of the Australian Constitution prohibits the federal government from making any law to establish any religion, impose any religious observance, or prohibit the free exercise of any religion. In the 2016 census, 52.1% of Australians were counted as Christian, including 22.6% as Roman Catholic and 13.3% as Anglican. And there was a small percentage of Jedi.
There were a small percentage of Jedi. It's so Australian. It's like, here, have a form. Oh, let's troll it.
30% of the population have reported no religion, 7.3% identify with non-Christian religions, the largest of these being Islam at 2.6%, followed by Buddhism 2.5%, Hinduism 1.9% and Judaism at 0.4%. Before European settlement, the animist beliefs of Australia's Indigenous people had been practiced for many thousands of years. Mainland Aboriginal Australian spirituality is known as the Dreamtime, and it places a heavy emphasis on the belonging to the land. The collection of stories that it contains shaped Aboriginal lore and customs. Aboriginal art, story, and dance continue to draw on these spiritual traditions. The spirituality and customs of Torres Strait Islanders, who inhabit the islands between Australia and New Guinea, reflected their Melanesian origins and dependence on the sea. The 1996 Australian Census counted more than 7,000 respondents as followers of a traditional Aboriginal religion. Continuing this trend of people migrating to this country and making a better life for themselves, our second act was also born overseas. Here's Dami Im with Sound of Silence from 2016.
Growing tired and weary, brown eyes. Trying to feel your love through FaceTime. Symphonies of dreams and highlights, caught up in this crazy fast life. But baby, you're not here with me. And I keep calling, calling, keep calling, calling. Now my heart. Crashing though. one here to save me drowning. 'Cause baby, you're not here with me. And I keep calling, calling, keep calling, girl. Now my heart awakes to the sound of silence, and it beats to the sound of silence, and it beats to the sound of silence. Now my heart awakes to the sound of silence, and it beats to the
Dami Im, born 1988 in Seoul, South Korea, is an Australian singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, performing artist. She emigrated to Australia with her family at the age of 9. She began learning the piano at the age of 5, and she taught herself to sing by recording herself copying her favourite artists.
Apparently one of them was the Spice Girls.
Oh, wow.
I know.
She won the 5th season of The X Factor Australia and subsequently received a recording contract with Sony Music Australia. She has released 3 albums. The song came a controversial second in the final on 511 points. And I say controversial because she should have bloody won the damn thing.
Justice for Dami.
Justice for Dami.
So the official clip, we've gone quite storyline this time, which is nice. We start with Dami in the car and it's kind of raining. You said that it looked like it was the Westfield Shopping Centre car park.
No, I said it looked like the underground High Point car park.
I'm pretty sure they didn't film it at High Point.
I don't know.
There's a guy dancing and he dances around quite a lot. I don't know if he's...
He's a parking attendant from High Point.
Stop it. Dami goes through a couple of costume changes and we've got Smoke Machine, which is also incredibly Eurovision.
Yes.
But the Eurovision stage performance.
I'm getting shivers now.
Before we get all emotional about it, we'll just go through the boxes, okay? That damn dress, that damn box... And that damn groovy screen, which meant she could interact with stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That was so cool.
Yeah.
She hit every note. She was flawless.
Uh-huh.
And I know from, you know, watching interviews with her and stuff that she's actually, you know, a very quiet, down-to-earth person.
Yeah.
As soon as she gets on stage, that's it. All bets are off. She gives 110%. And she did.
Oh, my God, did
at
she
At both
ever.
The semi and the final. You can actually watch both performances side by side on YouTube, and they're exactly the same. She was just that good.
And we're not just saying this because we are Australian, but she was really that good.
She was really that good. And that's why, you know, the Eurovision community has a strong Dami army, which is still around because we are so proud of how we did. So because this is the Odds and Sods episode and we can only pick 2 songs, unfortunately Isaiah did not make it.
It was okay.
Look, it was fine. It was fine. The Lazy Susan was fine. The Weird Selfies was fine. But yeah. Nothing compares to Dami. And the thing is, with this year, with having Jess, we can't help it. We're putting Jess on that pedestal.
Yeah.
Because Dami set the level.
She sure did.
She set the level. We thought fifth was good. Second was even sweeter. I don't even know how to do a segue for geography, climate and politics.
Just go to it.
Australia's landmass of, get this, 7,617,930 square kilometres.
In your face, Europe.
Is on the Indo-Australian plate. Surrounded by the Indian and Pacific Oceans, it is separated from Asia by the Arafura and Timor Seas, with the Coral Sea lying off the Queensland's coast and the Tasman Sea lying between Australia and New Zealand. The world's smallest continent and sixth largest country by total area, Australia, owing to its size and isolation, is dubbed an island continent and is sometimes considered the world's largest island. Australia has 34,218 kilometres of coastline.
A little bit different from our last country.
Yeah, it would take us a while to walk around the coastline of Australia. The climate of Australia is significantly influenced by ocean currents, including the Indian Ocean Dipole and El Nino Southern Oscillation. These are all very technical terms, aren't they? Which is correlated with periodic drought and seasonal tropical low-pressure systems, which produces cyclones in Northern Australia. And haven't we still got one hovering around?
When is there not?
Yeah, in FNQ, yeah. These factors cause rainfall to vary markedly from year to year. Much of the northern part of the country has a tropical, predominantly summer rainfall monsoon. The southwest corner of the country has a Mediterranean climate. The southeast ranges from oceanic Tasmania and coastal Victoria to humid subtropical upper half of New South Wales, and the interior is arid to semi-arid.
Speaking of arid, politics. Australia is a federal parliamentary constitutional monarchy with Elizabeth II at its apex as the Queen of Australia. Which, she is the Queen of England, but you know.
No, she's the Queen of Australia as well. She still owns us on paper.
A role that is distinct from her position as monarch of the other Commonwealth realms. The Queen is represented in Australia by the Governor-General at the federal level and by the governors at the state level, who by convention act on the advice of her ministers. Thus, in practice, the Governor-General has no actual decision-making or de facto government role, and merely acts as a legal figurehead for the actions of the Prime Minister and the Federal Executive Council. The Governor-General does have extraordinary reserve powers which may be exercised outside the Prime Minister's request in rare and limited circumstances, the most notable exercise of which was the dismissal of the Whitlam government in the constitutional crisis of 1975.
May we say God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
That's one of the most iconic quotes in Australian political history.
Oh, goodness, I hope I did it right.
I think that was right. Under the Constitution, the states essentially have plenary legislative power to legislate on any subject, whereas the Commonwealth Parliament may legislate only within the subject areas enumerated under Section 51 of whatever legislation. For example, state parliaments have the power to legislate with respect to education, criminal law, and state police, health, transport, and local government, but the Commonwealth Parliament does not have any specific power to legislate in these areas. However, Commonwealth laws prevail over state laws to the extent of the inconsistency. In addition, the Commonwealth has the power to levy income tax, which, coupled with the power to make grants to states, has given it the financial means to incentivize states to pursue specific legislative agendas within areas over which the Commonwealth does not have legislative power.
That was a long one.
Each state and major mainland territory has its own parliament, unicameral in the Northern Territory, the ACT in Queensland, and bicameral in the other states. Unlike America, we don't elect a person to lead the country. We elect a party.
We do.
And the leader of the party is then becomes Prime Minister. Elections are generally held every 3 years for Australia's federal government, which chooses its Prime Minister through the party. But
we've gone through a few Prime Ministers.
Yeah. See,
the Queen has met so many Prime Ministers, like, she must think, which one is this?
See, the problem of selecting a party as opposed to, like, a president is that the party can choose through a majority to ditch their leader, who then loses the Prime Ministership, and it goes to the next person who challenges them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what has happened in Australian politics for the last half dozen years or so. So, I don't know, we're on Prime Minister number 6,752.
Yeah.
Malcolm Turnbull is our current Prime Minister.
Well, it is today.
It is today. It could be on tomorrow.
Yeah, we don't know if it's on tomorrow, but we'll see. And if you ever want to have a bit of a laugh on Twitter, just look for the hashtag It's On.
State elections are held every 4 years.
Yes.
And the head of state is like, you know, in federal politics, but they're called premiers.
Yes.
Or in Northern Territory, they're called something else. And the name eludes me.
So, why is Australia in Eurovision? Let's just get this clear.
We wanted to, you know, troll every European country. No.
No! Australia has participated in the Eurovision Song Contest 3 times since its debut in 2015 in Vienna. The country's best result in the contest is 2nd place. Australia has finished in the top 10 each year.
And I still don't know how Isaiah got 9th, but yeah.
Thank you, jury.
Thank you, jury.
Australia's participation in the 2015 contest was set to be a one-off event, the plan being only to perform again the following year if they'd won. But it was confirmed in November 2015 that SVT, that they would participate in the 2016 contest, which of course was in Sweden. Australia is the first country from the Oceania region and the 2nd country outside Eurasia after Morocco in 1980, who just did it once, to participate in the contest. Australian broadcaster Special Broadcasting Service, otherwise known as SBS, or as my dad calls it, Sex Before Sport, first broadcast the Eurovision Song Contest in 1983 and has continued to do so every year since. The contest has attracted a viewing audience in Australia primarily because of the country's political ties to the European Union, particularly the United Kingdom. In the event that Australia should win the Eurovision Song Contest, the EBU has confirmed that in accordance with the rules, Australia would not host the event in the Southern Hemisphere. Instead, it would co-host the contest in Europe. And at the moment, it might be Germany.
Yeah.
You never know. That'd be nice. I'd like to go to Germany.
Yeah.
Few Australians have already been in Eurovision, including Johnny Logan, who represented Ireland, Olivia Newton-John and Gina G, who represented the UK, and Jane Comerford, who represented Germany, just to name a few. So many songwriters, so many backup dancers, so many backup singers have all been Australian.
Yep.
We've been there this whole time. It's not like we just appeared.
That's right.
Since 2015, Australia has sung every song in English. Of course. Australia gives their highest points to Belgium, Sweden and Bulgaria, and we receive our top points from Sweden, Poland Belgium, Denmark and Iceland.
So, yeah, we may have been officially in Eurovision a short time, but we have been part of the Eurovision family for a long time. And you can guess from our podcast, from other podcasts, friend of ours like Aussie Vision,
yep,
and other fans around Australia and Australians in other parts of Europe, we are rabid Eurovision fans. We love it.
I think Eurovision basically caters to Australia's love of competition.
Oh, yeah.
We love a competition. Like, the Commonwealth Games are on at the moment. And, of course, Australia loves the Commonwealth Games because there is no China or the US. So we really only have to beat England.
And Canada.
And Canada. And we love that because we like to be first. We like to be first in everything. And I think, like, when people ask me why I like Eurovision, it's because it's politics set to music. And we all like a good competition.
Oh.
And I think because we watched Eurovision before Australia joined, we still enjoyed it. We probably find it more stressful now.
Yes.
It was much easier for my stress levels and anxiety levels when Australia wasn't in the contest. But now it just makes it a whole new level.
Oh, yeah.
It makes it a whole new level. And we'll just officially say now, best of luck to Jess Malboy. She deserves to be there.
Yep.
She's a class act.
Yep.
The song's great. Can't wait to see the staging. Thumbs up, Jess.
Go, Jess.
Go, Jess. Good luck. So we've come to the end. We finally did it.
Did you guys make it through all right? It's very long.
You all right? You still with us? I know it's long, but it had to be this way. Next episode will be based on whichever country we draw out of the Vota Bene of Doom. All countries with five songs or more from 2000 onwards get a turn. That's the first time I haven't had to explain odds and sods. Yes! May I have a drum roll, please? Yunala-sand, do we have a valid result?
Yes, Danny. The valid result is in. Will you announce the winner, please?
Episode 39 of the Win Machine podcast. We're off to Germany.
Germany.
A top five.
Yes.
We've still got top fives in the beanie. Yeah. I can't believe it.
There's another eight countries in the beanie.
We're getting there, aren't we? Germany has had some humdingers the last few years, but it'll be very interesting to explore the early 2000s.
Mm.
And, of course, we have a winner.
Like a satellite.
I'm in orbital. And we can maybe talk about Lena's accent.
Oh, yeah.
We could probably make a whole podcast about Lena's accent because I don't know what's going on there because some of the time she actually sounds Australian.
Yeah. Mm.
Which is not a bad thing. Hey, we sound Australian.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, it's good to know. Before we finish up, could we have the legal announcement?
We at Wind Machine Podcasts have taken every legal step allowed to us to present this podcast with a current APRA license, and we claim fair use for the music played. We are not affiliated with the EBU, its partners, or SBS. We are just fans.
So the next episode will be the 2018 preview episode.
So you German fans, just hang on, it's coming.
It's okay, because we will definitely be doing Germany before Eurovision starts.
That's right.
Our reaction video.
Yes. Dun, dun, dun.
We have T-shirts. We have cups.
Yes.
We have flags. We also have something very secret that we will reveal in the video.
Yeah.
We're not going to say it now. We're not giving you any spoilers. But it will be a bit special.
So we will be recording that very, very soon.
So we're kind of hoping to have the video and the podcast out around the same time. Because the video will be more of reactionary stuff, while the podcast will be more,
you know, talking about the songs.
Yeah, and the facts about the artist and where they're from and all that stuff. So that'll be a little bit different. So if you want to watch us do amazing facial expressions, like I do a magnificent coit.
Hey, speak for yourself. I do a fantastic coit as well.
It's very upsetting being in front of a camera. I don't know if I can handle it because I'm way better behind a mic. So, yeah, so think of this. Our events coming up. We've got the video, the preview podcast, and then it will be Germany. Keep in touch with our social medias and you'll be able to figure out, because if you don't do songs before Eurovision, stay clear of both of those.
Yeah.
So I've been Danny Tregoning, and you can find me on Twitter, DanieTreg.
And I'm Mark Perkins. You can find me on Twitter at MarkPerkinsVO.
You can find the Twitter account for the podcast at WinMachinePod.
Like us on Facebook.
Also, you can find us on pretty much every podcasty something.
Pretty much most of them.
All of them. We're even on SoundCloud now. They've let us on there, which is really nice. But, of course, we're on iTunes, TuneIn, Podbean.
And speaking of SoundCloud, I've been uploading our old episodes.
Ah, yes.
All one of you have listened to them. That's great. But I'll continue putting those old podcasts up for anyone that uses SoundCloud.
Now, if you're not into SoundCloud and you do want to go back and listen to some of our old ones, they're all on our website, which is windmachinepodcast.com. Okay. Well, that's it. We made it.
For our probably longest episode ever.
I know, but we are cramming three countries in. Maybe you can split it up, you know. Have bits each. That's what I would do. You know, when you're having a cake, you don't eat the whole cake in one go. You have slices.
Yeah, so if you're listening, you can just, you know, oh, for this trip to work, I'll just listen to Slovakia. And then on the way home, I'll listen to Monaco. And maybe after dinner, I'll listen to Australia.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think that's a good idea. So if you've done that, let us know. And if you've sat through the whole thing in one go, I hope you've been to the toilet. And you are, you know, okay, and you've had enough liquid and not dehydrated, because I can tell you I am, and I'm desperate for a cup of tea.
Oh, hell, yes. Oh,
okay, so we'll be back soon with other stuff, and then after that, Germany. Until then,
goodbye.
Bye.